This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Memorial Day weekend as we really pay homage to those who paid the ultimate sacrifice in defending our country. It's also that first weekend of summer. And there are so many things we need to be very, very careful of. Last night, unfortunately, I was being consulted by the family of a professional athlete who unfortunately had a situation where their young child was playing with his toy tractor that he was riding on, and it went into a river. And unfortunately, the child is severely ill. And it just brings to mind, the importance of safety in young children around water. Okay? It's just you cannot take your eyes off these children, even for a second, because they will venture into whatever that other thing is, whether it be a swimming pool, whether it be a pond. We have plenty of this around us. So please, please, please pay attention to young children. And for many of us, our homes are not, kid-proofed necessarily. So we really have to be mindful of that. The other thing to be very cautious of is the sun. Dr. Penoyer has been a guest on our program and talked to us quite a bit about the use of sunscreen, that you make sure that it protects you against UVA and UVB light forms and light waves. And, the fact that in this country we are challenged because I'm finding out now that in the European Union, they have some better products than we use here that give you more protection. And with each year, we need more and more protection because things are changing. And I think we become aware of that every time we open a newspaper or turn on a broadcast with respect to the sun and trying to use products that have zinc oxide or titanium oxide becomes crucial. So again, let's be careful so we have a great summer. Last week, we chatted with Dr. Mary Gina Ratchford, and we chatted about vision and the use of sunglasses, but also we spent time chatting about her medical mission to Guatemala, and I want to make sure I give that website for those of you listening who wish to donate to a worthwhile charity that goes out not only internationally, but in our country, in our own country, going to underserved areas to provide vision care. So that website is www.visionhealth.org. This day in medicine, May 25th, 1753, Captain James Lund published his report on the prevention of scurvy by the intake of citrus fruits. Now, it's interesting because he was a Scottish physician, and he did a lot with respect to the Navy and hygiene in the Navy. And he published his treatise on scurvy, but also did a lot from the standpoint of advocating for better ventilation on ships. Cleanliness among the sailors, their clothing, their bedding, fumigation below the deck of ships. And don't forget, this is in the mid-1700s that this is going on. And he proposed actually a system for being able to distill seawater into fresh water. So we remember Captain James Lind, who was a Scottish physician, and his outstanding publication on scurvy. My guest today, going to be first, Mr. James Littlefield. Jim Littlefield is a historian and an author. And as you can tell from regular listeners to our program, I have an interest, and I think many of the listeners have an interest, in kind of medical history. And he wrote a fascinating book called Treasured Tales of from the New England Shore. And in it, particularly one chapter, talks a lot about medicine. And I'm going to have him come on the show at 11:15 to chat with us a little bit about his book and about what got him to write this book. He's a local author. Then in the second half of our program, Dr. Tanya Bilchik is going to join us. It's been a little while since we had her join us, but you know, she was one of the original guests. I mean, 14 years ago, she was one of the first few guests we had on our program, and it's great to have her join us periodically. As many of you know, she's an assistant professor of neurology at Yale, and she specializes in headache medicine. So let me just establish now, if you have questions and you want to get them on the air for Dr. Bilchik in the second half of the program, email me now at info@alessimd.com. So we're taking questions about headache, types of headaches, treatments. There are so many different treatments now. There have been so many advances in the field of headache medicine. So get those over to me now, and I'm happy to ask her live on the air. A couple of things. You know, for many people, We're used to having football on Thanksgiving Day. And a friend of mine, Mike DeMauro, who is a columnist for the New London Day, wrote an interesting piece this past week about where tradition intersects with safety. And I don't want to get into the politics of it, but a state senator introduced, well, there is, you know, they say when you watch a bill being made in politics, in Congress, it's like watching sausage being made. And I think this is one of those situations where out of nowhere in a bill from the Finance, Revenue, and Bonding Committee, they added a sentence about boards shall not delegate the authority to schedule interscholastic football games on Thanksgiving Day to any nonprofit organization. And it goes on and on. But basically, the gist of this is that they want to preserve football on Thanksgiving Day because it's a tradition, which is fine. The problem here is that the high school football season has gotten longer. It extends now to December 14th. And now you're in the middle of playoffs. And as it stands now, I mean, if they were to do this and have a Thanksgiving traditional game, right, they would be playing four games in 17 days, which is ridiculous, okay? The NFL doesn't do that. It's ironic because in Connecticut, we have a rule that says every high school has to have a bye week to give their football players a chance to have their bodies recover. And then by the same token, we're going to do four games in 17 days. The human body is very resilient to injury if you give it a chance to rest. And you also bring out the best in athletes. So the issue here really is you could do several things. You want to have Thanksgiving? Great. End the football season sooner. Maybe a shorter season. Less chance of injury. Okay? But by the same token, you may have to give something up if you want to have all these playoffs and have all these teams. I mean, just this year, there are going to be 12 teams participating in playoff-level football until December 14th. So it's one of those situations where sometimes government needs to butt out of the situation, or at least ask the people who know the most. Ask the team physicians, the team athletic trainers. And in the article, every athletic trainer in Connecticut is against this because they know what it's like at the end of a football season trying to deal with injury and the need for recovery and rest. With that, we're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my guest, Jim Littlefield, author and historian. We're going to be talking about his book, Treasured Tales from the New England Shore. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to have as my first guest today, Mr. James Littlefield. Jim is a historian, an author. He was a teacher of history at East Lyme High School and has written several books, but his most recent work has been Treasured Tales from the New England Shore. And I wanted to get him on to talk a little bit about the book and specifically a chapter that I had some interest in from the standpoint of medicine. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the invite.
Hey, Jim, how did you become interested in local history and local archaeology?
Well, I think it kind of came naturally for me. I come from a family, the Littlefields and the Bulls. My mother was a Bull, have pretty well-documented past. So we grew up with all the stories of the family. We visited the local cemetery where there's a big plot of Littlefields down at Union Cemetery. And I think, you know, it's a lot of the stories, a lot of the people we knew about them. So I grew up on 100 acres of Littlefield property, which we had owned since 1861. And there was a lot of history there. And we live right next door to Bride Brook, which was the scene of that famous colonial wedding in the 1600s. And right near East Lyme's first school, the Little Boston Schoolhouse and the Thomas Lee House. So all of these historical things were part of my daily life. I just kind of grew up with history, I guess.
One of the things that I was most impressed with in your book is the detail and research that you spend on that. How do you go about investigating a topic?
Well, this by the way, this archaeology thing that you mentioned, local history meant a lot to me, but archaeology, my grandfather, Norris L. Bull, was the founder of the first Connecticut Archaeological Society up in West Hartford. So I kind of grew up with archaeology. Now, if you're talking about an archaeological site and how we go about it, it's all, you know, pretty standard. You know, you go and you pick something that you think will bear fruit, and you lay out, you do test holes. Seldom do we use a metal detector, but once in a while we do. We lay out a grid. That grid is laid out kind of like what you'd expect latitude and longitude to look like. Kids are given a 4-inch trowel, and we begin an ascent down, trying to find artifacts as we go. We have a couple of sifters. Kids are armed with plastic baggies, and they label the different squares that the artifacts come up in. And when all is said and done, we go back to school, and we have a lab back at East Lyme High School, and we try to make sense out of the place that we investigated. But it's all pretty standard. It starts with test holes, and if that bears fruit, then we go to the units and go from there.
I'm impressed by the fact that you didn't mention the internet one time in this research that you do with these young people.
No.
I'm sure they love getting their hands dirty as well.
Yeah, they love that, and they also enjoy, you know, primary documents. I mean, the internet is great for a lot of things, but, you know, most of the time when we go out on an archaeological dig, we do have some primary documentation that leads us to the site, and we can kind of put the artifacts, you know, together along with our with what's been said about it. We found. Oh, God, I'm thinking back now. We've located a blacksmith shop, a pestilence house, a hearse house. We found the original location for the first one-room schoolhouse in town. And my class has even discovered a Revolutionary War skirmish site on the banks of the Nyanic River. So, you know, archaeology has been very good to us. you know, with the kids really, I think, enjoyed the experience.
Well, let's get to the medical part of this. So one chapter in your book is about March Madness. So I was particularly interested in the discussion about smallpox. So can you give our listeners a little summary of what you found out and revealed in that chapter?
Yeah, that chapter was a result of some tombstone restoration that I was doing with another fella. We had been given a permission to fix some of the tombstones that were up at the Pestilence House Cemetery. It's one of 19 cemeteries in East Lyme. And while we were there, we did repair two tombstones. But while doing that, I noticed that the death dates were both in March. And as we looked at some of the other people that had died of infectious diseases in that cemetery, March appeared more often than maybe you'd expect. So I began to wonder whether or not that, you know, there was a seasonality to this. One of the tombstones did say that the person died of smallpox. The other person did not give a cause of death, but we happen to have a primary document from the records of the doctor of the deceased stating what he died of, and it was of infectious virus as well. So we started to look at that. Now, I'm sure that you could test to this much more better than I could, but I really think that there is a connection between smallpox and March, and I think it has to do with people, you know, their immune systems are depressed at that time, and they're coming out of hibernation, so to speak. They have not had their immune systems depressed. You know, I just think that that's a time when they are very vulnerable, and that seems to be the time when that disease seemed to strike the most. With other diseases that we researched, whether it was yellow fever caused by mosquitoes, or typhus, lice, or cholera, or plague comes from fleas, those tend to have, I think, seasonal patterns for those bacteria and different things that are causing those. So that was kind of an interesting thing. We didn't plan on talking about diseases. Mainly we were planning on just fixing tombstones, but that's where we ended out.
Well, what I found interesting was that when we did have the smallpox vaccine, and smallpox has been wiped from the globe thanks to vaccination, but even back in the early 1900s, there was a movement in East Lyme of anti-vaccination.
That is correct.
Which, you know, we hear about this now and all this anti-vax, but there were some people there that despite having lived through this horrendous epidemic, pandemic, that people were still against it even back then. So this anti-science way of thinking is not something new.
No, it's not something new. And, of course, we know how history repeats itself. But yeah. I think it has a lot to do with people. You know, people are afraid sometimes of that. They don't want to be told what to do. They don't think it'll happen to them. You know, there's all kinds of rationale, but it certainly doesn't make sense. I mean, thank God that George Washington had his troops vaccinated against smallpox, or we may not have won the Revolutionary War.
We might still be part of England. Hey, Jim, in closing, can you tell everybody how to get a hold of your book? Because I really want to recommend it highly to folks, especially those of us of a certain age who can really relate to many of the stories in there.
Yeah, all my books, the five books that I've written, the two novels and the three local history books, you can get on Amazon. But in town locally, at the Old Red Salt Box, you can get all my books there. And this new one, Treasured Tales from the New England Shore, is available at the Book Barn and Bayberry's on Pennsylvania Avenue. Those people have been very, very good to me. They love local history, and they like having my books to offer the public.
Jim, thank you. Thanks for your time today in making us aware of this, and I look forward to chatting with you more about this.
I thank you very much.
Take care. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my next guest, Dr. Tanya Bilchik. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And it's great to be joined in the second half of our program by Dr. Tanya Bilchik. Dr. Bilchik is an assistant professor of neurology at Yale University, but prior to that had been spent many years in private practice in the Hartford area, as many people will remember. She's been one of our original guests on the program some 14 years ago, and it's great because our interviews with her, as I look back, really span the recent history of treatments for headaches. So it's great to have her back on. Tanya, welcome back to the show.
Great. Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be back, and I didn't realize we started that long ago. So you and I are both becoming vintage neurologists.
That's a good way to put it. Let's talk. How about giving everybody a little overview of headache and some of the headache demographics that we deal with in general?
Absolutely. So headache is actually, in migraine particularly, and all different varieties of headaches, actually incredibly common. And in the U.S., about 40 million people have migraine. So that's one in five women between the ages of 17 and about 60. Migraines affect women twice as much as men. Although in kids, it's interesting because boys have migraines as frequently as girls. And as women start developing menarche and hormonal changes, their frequency of migraine increases. So migraine is probably the commonest headache disorder that we see in a clinical practice. However, it's not the most common headache disorder. The most common headache disorder that everybody has experienced is probably a tension-type headache. Tension headaches are mild to moderate, generalized, can get worse as the day goes on, generally doesn't get worse with exercise, and does not have migraine features. And just to kind of mention the migraine features again, it's a moderately severe headache. It does not have to have a migraine aura. That only happens in about one in five people. However, the cardinal findings or symptoms of migraine are light sensitivity, noise sensitivity, and or nausea. Now, you don't need to be a neurologist to make a diagnosis of migraine. It's actually pretty simple. There are three very simple questions that you can ask if you think you have a migraine or your primary care doc thinks you have a migraine, and it's called ID migraine, and the questions are, does my headache get worse with activity? Do I stop doing things because I have a headache? When I have a headache, does life bother me? And when I have a headache, do I feel nauseous or kind of some kind of stomach discomfort? It's as simple as that. That's how you make a diagnosis of migraine.
When we approach a migraine, okay, and I think you've given such a great summary here of migraine headaches. When we approach migraine and when we get to see people, many have tried over-the-counter medications, almost to their own detriment. Can you talk a little bit about that approach?
Absolutely. And in fact, we are usually not the first people that people seek care from. It's usually the primary care provider or, in fact, in a lot of women, it's the gynecologist. And I always get the story, oh, I took Excedrin, I took ibuprofen, I took Aleve, and it was fine, and I did well for a while, and then the medicine stopped working, and then I started taking more and more of it, and it wasn't working, and they told me that, I need to go see somebody about it, and in fact, this is not uncommon. There are a lot of over-the-counter medications that are really effective, but the problem is they're not effective for everybody, and if you take too much, it actually causes what we call medication overuse headaches. So I've been practicing headache and neurology since the early 90s, and so we've seen quite a revolution in migraine-specific medications. In the 90s, we had a group of medications called triptans, which are migraine-specific, And in the last 6 years, we've actually had a whole new class of medications called gepants. So I would still say that most of the time, if you have episodic headaches that go away with an over-the-counter medication and it always works, we don't need any more than what we've got. But what we're seeing is people who either overusing medication, causing medication overuse headaches, or the non-specific anti-inflammatories aren't working anymore. So there's been an evolution in migraine treatment and headache treatment over the last 30 years.
Here's a question that just came in from Margaret. So she says, I've been able to stop caffeine withdrawal headache with a few drops of cayenne extract in water. How does that work is what she's actually asking, and it's worked for her. Have you heard of that? Because I have not.
No, I haven't, but it's interesting that you bring up the cayenne and the whole pepper and the capsaicin, because capsaicin actually applied to nerve terminals can actually treat nerve pain. So I wonder, you know, and caffeine withdrawal headaches are kind of lack of caffeine or, you know, you have a cup of coffee every day and suddenly you don't have your coffee, you get a headache. But I've not heard of using capsaicin drops. But I do wonder, because topical capsaicin does, quote unquote, numb the nerve ending. So I wonder if it's doing something like that.
It's interesting because her pharmacist in the next sentence told her about the capsaicin and how we use that to deaden nerve endings. So interesting. Yeah. I have another question from Pat. And this one is, when someone presents with headache, do they automatically need a scan, a CT scan? I would expand it to say, in your opinion, when people present to a neurologist with headaches, do they automatically need an imaging study?
That's very, you know, when we teach our residents and our fellows and our medical students, we talk about red flags in headache, and I've expanded that to talk about green flags in headache. So these are the things that make me concerned, you know, and that's when you need the scan. If it's a sudden onset, new worst headache of my life, you need a scan. Never had a headache before and suddenly over the age of 50 develop headaches that you've never had before, need a scan. Headaches with focal neurological symptoms, in other words, numbness, weakness, you know, we call, you know, focal neurologic symptoms, definitely need a scan, rule out something bad. Not every headache needs a scan. And I think here's my green flag list of things. You have a patient or a person who has a family history of migraine, they develop migraine, the headaches are always the same, they are totally headache-free in between attacks. That's a green flag. Headaches with menstrual cycle, always with the menstrual cycle, pretty typical. It's a green flag. Same kind of headache all the time. You know, episodic as long as headache-free in between, that's a green flag. You know, we've been caught sometimes by having headache patients that have a change in headache pattern. Now, that is, again, something that you want to scan. So if somebody has a typical migraine, say you develop, you've got your 16-year-old young lady who develops migraine and mom has migraine and grandma has migraine, never had migraines before, headache, typical migraine features, has had a bunch of them pretty similarly, I don't think you need to scan. But if that same person has no family history of headache, has had a head injury, or has had headache with fever, or headache like as somebody with a known immunosuppression, like an HIV patient, or a patient that's on chemotherapy or something like that with new onset headache, I'd absolutely scan. Not every headache needs a scan, and not every time the same migraine patient goes to the emergency room because the headache won't go away, they don't always need a scan. But we tend to err on the side of caution.
How about the therapeutic scan? I mean, the patient who comes to you.
Well,
with,
that's
okay. The tension headache, all they want is a picture. Okay.
Well, you know, and again, that's not a terrible kind of way to approach it as long as you can kind of justify it. I think that the comorbidities of migraine with anxiety, depression, correct, PTSD, head trauma, all of those things, you know, people just need reassurance. We live in a very anxious, very concerning society. And if you can reduce some of that by getting a, you know, and don't waste time getting a head CT scan. In the day that we've got MRIs, I'd much rather get an MRI, even if we have to wait a little longer to get it, because it's much more sensitive. So, you know, we can call it a therapeutic scan, or we can say rule out something terrible. But think of the amount of healthcare time and energy that would be spent if you didn't get that scan, reassuring somebody that they had nothing wrong. So I don't think it's a bad approach. And, you know, we also have the attitude that if anybody presents with a headache and has never had headaches before, you're having a first scan is reassuring that there's nothing anatomically wrong. It's a physiological problem.
It is, and I'm glad you brought up the expense from the standpoint of how much money had been spent just getting to you, okay, and all
right.
They wanted was a scan and some picture of reassurance that they did not have a brain tumor or other structural problem. I'm glad you brought that up. But
part
I want to move on a little
bit. Sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
I think part of the problem that people face is, you know, primary care would make life very easy, but a lot of times they have to get prior authorization for every single test that they get. And, you know, with the amount of things that a primary care provider has to do, getting yet another thing, getting prior authorization for that imaging study is difficult and time consuming. So it's a lot easier for a neurologist to order a head CT or an MRI than a primary care doc. And the other thing about imaging is you need to know what to do with the information that you get. And we often find, and, you know, I get phone calls all the time, there's this little dot on my MRI, I don't know what to do. Because now patients get the imaging studies almost before you do. And so, you know, it's nice to be able to have the knowledge to say, oh, that's normal, that's common, don't worry about that. And so I think that, you know, yeah, reassuring to get a scan, but also you need to have the knowledge that whatever you're finding on the imaging studies is something to worry about or not to worry about. And that's why I think often primary care providers know that they could get a scan, but it's just sometimes not as easy as it is for a neurologist.
I'm glad you brought that, the communication aspect, because although the MyChart app has helped a lot with communication, it's also set off a fair amount of panic when somebody gets a CT scan or MRI report that shows things that are not of consequence, but embellishes them in the report to the point where it sets off a panic. But I want to move on to cervicogenic headache, because obviously I see a lot of it in sports and people who come in thinking they had a concussion. But cervicogenic headaches play a big part of headache medicine. Can you talk a little bit about them?
Yes. You know, it's not uncommon. Again, and I'm seeing more cervicogenic headaches. Yes, concussions, minor head injuries, minor whiplash. And that is really more a headache stemming from the upper cervical nerve. And the myofascial part of it is also really huge. And it's it can be unilateral, both sides. People may not even be aware of the trigger. So you're seeing it more in the sports and in the kind of injury world. I'm seeing it more in people that are getting older. Or, you know, they've got degenerative changes of the neck on imaging studies, and they're getting these nonspecific headaches that, you know, are related to those tight neck muscles. And my treatment is actually to refer people to physical therapy and sometimes to physiatry for nerve blocks. But I do think cervicogenic headaches are underdiagnosed. And, you know, if you look at the International Headache Society classification of cervicogenic headache, you know, they say it's unilateral, you should be able to reproduce it by certain maneuvers, and it should improve with nerve blocks. But I think we're seeing not the classic definition of cervicogenic headache, but headaches that are coming from the upper cervical nerve roots and tight neck muscles a lot more.
In the same area, since it's on my mind, is occipital neuralgia. Okay, I think we see a fair amount of that as well, especially in people who have had neck injury or had trauma. Can you talk a little bit about occipital neuralgia?
Sure. The occipital nerve is a nerve that is from the upper cervical nerve roots as the nerve exits the neck base of the skull area. And again, typical classical occipital neuralgia is unilateral, sharp, steady pain. And one of the treatments, which is pretty impressive when you have the patients in the clinic, is to take Novocaine, Lidocaine, Bupivacaine, any numbing medicine, and injecting it around that nerve area, which is, if you feel halfway between the little bump at the back of your head and the bone behind your ear, one of them is called the occipital protuberance, the other is the mastoid process. So those two bumps, and halfway in between that is where the occipital nerve is. And if you can numb that, it actually takes that pain away pretty quickly. It's really impressive. And people will often tell you they can point to that occipital tenderness, that occipital nerve. And again, that nerve can be damaged spontaneously, trauma, very tight neck muscles, degenerative disease. And it's pretty impressive getting rid of that pain almost immediately. Unfortunately, that doesn't always stay gone. You have to sometimes repeat the nerve block or occasionally send them to pain management to dull or deaden the nerve. But it's more common than you think. Again, it's another one of those things that if you read the classification, you have to be able to reproduce it. You have to be able to take it away. But it's more common. And sometimes even physical therapy in combination with nerve medications and nerve blocks will take that pain away for months.
You know what I find is when it works in the office, it's one of the most rewarding things we do in the sense that you can produce some immediate relief from a headache that has been troublesome for a long period of time.
Yeah, no, that's impressive. And the other thing you can sometimes do in occipital nerve block, and we're not saying under x-ray guidance, neurologists just kind of feel around for where they think the nerve is and numb it, but it also works pretty well in other acute headache disorders. We can do those blocks in migraine, in cluster headaches. And it's one of the things that I will often do in pregnant women because there's not a lot of things you can do in migraine in pregnancy because you don't want things to go systemic. But it's also helpful in treating and hopefully reducing migraines during pregnancy, which in and of itself is a challenge.
Tanya, I want to get on to treatments. You mentioned the gepants. Can you talk a little, I'll give everybody a little bit of overview of these new gepants and how they're used?
Gepants actually are small molecules that block one of the receptors in migraine called the CGRP receptor, calcitonin gene-related peptide receptor. And they actually started looking at blocking CGRP in the late 1990s. So this is not new technology. The theory on migraine was that one of the nerve chemicals or neuropeptides that was released during acute migraine was CGRP. And if you could block that CGRP from getting to its receptor, you could treat or prevent migraine. So they started out with older drugs in the late 90s that unfortunately looked very effective but caused liver enzyme abnormalities. So that got shelved for a long time. And then about 15 years later, again, more technology purifying the molecules, they came up with these small molecules. There are two of them that are used in acute migraine, rimagepant, trade name Nurtec, and Ubrogepant, trade name Ubrelvy. And these are oral medications that you take at the onset of migraine, which then blocks the CGRP receptor. That prevents the CGRP, this neuroinflammatory peptide, from reaching its receptor, and in that way treating the migraine. So They are effective. They work well. But what's really nice about them is they have very, very few side effects. So the positive is they work. You can take them at the onset of migraine. They don't cause medication overuse headaches. And they work effectively. And they take away the migraine. The only problem at this stage is the cost because they're all branded. So we've got great new acute medications for people that have had trouble taking some of the older migraine-specific triptan medications. You know, in the 90s, we called them Imitrex and Maxalt and Zomig, and now they're generic sumatriptan, rizatriptan, zomatriptan, et cetera. That family of drugs is really effective, but they were contraindicated. In other words, you couldn't use them in people that had vascular abnormalities. They had a fair number of side effects. So the newer drugs have less side effects, don't have those contraindications, but unfortunately are a little more expensive, actually a lot more expensive at the moment.
In closing, what does everybody need to know now about the treatment of headache? What's the latest thing that we should be aware of? Because I still remember when you first talked about the G-PANTS when we were starting on the show and giving more information about it. But what's the next big thing that we should know about, Tanya?
Well, the G-PANTS actually have come out with not only for acute treatment, but they're also for prevention. So both there's a new one, Qulipta, Q-U-I-L-I-P-T-A, atogepant, and rimagepant, which is Nurtec, both have data, and very good data, that work effectively for migraine prevention. So I think that's a newer way of preventing migraine. I think they also don't cause medication overuse, which I think is important. I think what we need to know about migraine treatment is it's available. We have tons and tons of options. The medications, including the older meds, are really effective. And I also want to kind of push for migraine prevention. Even though my job depends on seeing patients that have headaches more days than not days, we call that kind of chronic migraine, chronic daily headache. I think if we optimize acute treatment, be it with over-the-counter medications, migraine-specific medications, lifestyle changes, everything, if we can work on adequate prevention, and we've now got a lot of new migraine preventive medications and old migraine preventive medications, we won't run into the chronic daily headache. I've had a headache every day for like 15 years type of thing. So if we can work on prevention, and I think the new data is lifestyle, education, relaxation, hydration, stress management, biofeedback, and all of the alternative techniques, I think that we will come a long way in reducing the frequency of chronic headache.
Tanya, thank you. Thank you for your time. And for listeners, if you wish to contact Dr. Bilczyk, her office number, 877-925-3637. Tanya, once again, thank you for your time and sharing all this great information with our listeners.
Great, and happy Memorial Day, everybody.
Thank you. Thank you. Many thanks to our studio producer, Kevin Kors, who's been on the board today. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. If you missed any part of today's program, you can get the Healthy Rounds podcast and download it free at odyssey.com. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rachford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.